Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the program, we'll be talking about politics in Mexico. And our guest should be familiar to people who listen to public radio. He is now the Mexico correspondent for The World, a radio program that we broadcast here on the station at 3 in the afternoon and 7 in the evening. He has also reported for NPR, the BBC, and the CBC. Our guest is Frank Contreras. He's been reporting from Mexico City and around Latin America since 1996. He covered the elections in Mexico in 2000. He has reported from each of Mexico's states. He has also reported from other places around Latin America, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Panama, and Venezuela. Before going to Mexico City, he was a founding producer and news editor for the program Latino USA, which is also broadcast here on AM 580. And then before that, he worked for All Things Considered as a segment producer. He's visiting the campus here, his visit sponsored by a number of organizations, including the folks at La Casa, the Association of Hispanic Journalists, the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies, the Latino Studies Program, and the Student Cultural Programming Fee, all of those folks contributing. And he also will be giving a talk. He's here to meet with students, and we'll be talking with a student journalist. But he is also giving a talk that would be open to anyone about contemporary American politics. And that's tonight at 7 o'clock in 180 Bevere Hall. So anybody who is interested should feel welcome to attend. And here on the program, anybody who wants to call and ask questions should feel welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Great to have you here. I appreciate it.
Thank you, David. Thanks for inviting me. It's really good to be here with you and with the listeners.
I want to first to talk a little bit, perhaps go back and talk just a little bit about the election that took place in July. People in Mexico cast votes for the Congress, for the Mexican Congress, but also for president. And the two top finishers came very close, but apparently now officially the winner has been declared to be Felipe Calderón, the man who was the candidate of the National Action Party, the party of the current president. He was the former energy minister, running a very close second, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He was the mayor of Mexico City. He's the candidate of the PRD, the Democratic Revolutionary Party. And initially, I think people will remember, initially, Mr. López Obrador said he would not accept the result. He said there was electoral fraud, and he urged his supporters to turn out. And indeed, for weeks, there were demonstrations in Mexico City protesting the results of the election. Well, sometime after that, officially, the Election Commission said Mr. Calderón was the winner. He is due to be inaugurated December 1st, just a couple of weeks from now. So, having said all that, has now the dust settled and has Mr. López Obrador accepted the result of the election?
By no means, David, by no means. If you're looking for political stability south of the border, that's not happening just now. In fact, I would say that the dust has not settled. The dust is actually, there's more dust in the air, literally, because three bombs went off last week in Mexico City. I don't know if you heard about the news. A coalition of guerrilla, that's armed guerrilla organizations, detonated three bombs, one of them at the headquarters of the Institutional Revolutionary Party, one of the parties that governed Mexico for 70 years. And one of the bombs also went off at the Federal Electoral Tribunal. That's the court that gave the final decision on this very controversial July presidential election. So the guerrilla organization said that, these kinds of explosive devices will go off more if you don't start to fix things in the southern state of Oaxaca, which we'll talk about in a second here, and if we don't start to talk about what actually went on with the election. So there's by no means has the dust settled. It's going to get more and more complicated as Mr. Calderón is sworn into office on December 1st, as you mentioned. He will become one of Mexico's youngest presidents. He will try to keep Mexico on its project of opening itself to international investors here from Illinois and from other parts of the United States, but he's going to have a very, very difficult task, political task in front of him.
Well, I think what this says is that Mexico, if you look at the election result, what it says is that Mexico is a place that is very sharply divided. It's divided regionally, north-south. It's divided politically, left-right. It's divided economically between more affluent people and those who are less well-off, with that support going clearly to one candidate or the other. Mr. Calderon, he tended to be supported by Northerners, more affluent people, more conservative people. Mr. Lopez Obrador got more support in the Central and South from people who are on more on sort of the left side of the political spectrum, people who are – he got a lot of support from poor people, and that it says that Mexican politics is very divided and raises the question about, well, how exactly does Mr. Calderon govern now, given that?
Well, yes, I think that became very clear to me after 10 years of covering Mexico in a very detailed way that – you know, we know that the country's been divided, but this revealed just how profound those divisions are. And I think that as a result of the controversial election, the country became even more divided. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a sense that Mexico, with this presidential election, might join a number of other South American countries, which have in recent years swung to the left, as you know. That's Venezuela, countries like even Argentina, Brazil, places of that sort, opting for a new leftist approach to try to deal with the economic situation in the region. There was a sense that that might happen, and it didn't happen. Mexico stays now with a right-leaning party that is governing here at the federal level. But how will Mr. Calderon try to deal with this? He says what he wants to do is produce jobs. And, you know, the lack of jobs, or I should say the lack of good-paying jobs, is largely, of course, the reason why so many Mexicans have been coming to the United States over these recent years. We're talking about more than 400,000 Mexicans every year for the last 6 years that President Vicente Fox has been in office. That starts to break records. Those are the official numbers. Remember, there's no way to calculate exactly how many undocumented Mexicans have crossed the border and are now in our communities right here in Illinois and all over the United States. So how does Felipe Calderon start to try to govern this? He says he's going to start by trying to create these jobs. It's going to be very difficult. The economic forecast for Mexico, by the way, is not looking good in the first quarter of his presidency. There's going to be a slight downturn, according to many of the analysts that I've been speaking to. So that's not good for Mexico. It might not be very good news for foreign investors. And it's certainly going to, again, further complicate the situation the incoming president will face.
Yeah. Well, within the Mexican Congress, there are a lot of people who either supported the PRI or the PRD, so there are already legislators that are maybe not inclined to support the Mr. Calderon's agenda. There are a number of states where some other party holds the governorship. So how is it even going to be possible for him to try to advance his program if already he's got people, in particularly in the national legislature, who didn't support him? And you know, you also have to consider the fact that something like 25 million Mexicans voted for somebody else.
Well, I think what I'd like to do is begin by explaining that Mexico is an electoral democracy. For the first time in more than 70 years, in the year 2000, the Mexican political system opened itself up and allowed for a separate political party to come in and take power. One party held power for 71 years. Can you imagine what would it be like for you if the Democrats held power for 71 years? Or what would it be like for you if the Republicans held power for 71 years? Imagine that. Mm. What does that mean for a political system? That's what happened in our neighbor to the south. 71 years of one-party rule. That was broken up in the year 2000. In 1997, just in 1997, the Congress became more plural. Another party stepped in, the PAN. The National Action Party of President Vicente Fox started to gain more seats. And now, with this controversial presidential election of 2006, the left-leaning party, the PRD, starts to gain more seats. So this is definitely a multi-party electoral democracy. I'd like to underscore that because we'll talk a little further here about the fact that, you know, it might be the electoral system that's working, but the rest of the country does not appear to be working its institutions. What kind of chances does Mr. Calderon have to pass very important reforms? We're talking about labor reforms or just simple bureaucratic business reforms. Let's say you wanted to open a business in Mexico City. You've got a small business here in Illinois and you want to open up an office there. It's extremely bureaucratic, very difficult proposition. And if you're a Mexican, it's even more so. So they're trying to streamline these issues, trying to open up the energy sector, which is a very important sector for the United States as well. We have lots of gas, natural gas that's produced, and petroleum that's shipped out of Mexico to the United States. So how does Mr. Calderon try to achieve these reforms? Well, these are the very same reforms that Vicente Fox wanted to undergo, to implement when he took office in 2000, and he ran into a stone wall because the Congress was so divided. Now, today, the Congress is even more divided. So it's going to be, we're looking at a very, very difficult proposition for Mexico, for change in Mexico.
Yeah. Let me just very quickly mention, our guest this morning is Frank Contreras. He's Mexico correspondent for The World, their radio program we broadcast here on the station. He's been reporting from Mexico City and around Latin America for now more than 10 years. His stories have been broadcast on NPR, on the BBC and CBC. He's here visiting the campus to talk about politics in Mexico, in part to do that and also to meet with students. And questions here are welcome, by the way. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. I mentioned at the beginning of the program that you had covered the presidential election in 2000 when Mr. Fox was elected. And as you say, this was the first time in more than 70 years that a party other than the PRI was in control on the national scene. And I think that clearly this was an historic event, if only for that fact. Did that really change Mexican politics substantially when Mr. Fox became president?
You know, what an important question that is. I think we're still trying to get the answer exactly. But I would say, having lived there, you know, and to actually witness it and live with the system, to understand what does it mean to have political corruption, I would say that at the very beginning of his term, it seemed like a world-changing event. It was unthinkable that the PRI would lose. And on the day of the election in July 2000, I was in a poor part of Mexico City that was stronghold of the PRI, the Institutional Revolutionary Party. And I have to tell you, I was definitely off the mark because I was absolutely convinced that the PRI was going to do anything it needed to win the election one more time and get seven more years, to make it 77 years without stop. That one party had controlled Mexico, and it didn't happen. So all of a sudden, this started to create a newfound and very unusual faith in the institutions of electoral democracy in Mexico. This is something that, remember, after years and decades of corruption, of elections being stolen, of an election being stolen where the computer fails one night, and the next morning the PRI candidate remarkably wins the election again. You know, to start to show people that, wait, your system can work for you, your vote does count. This was world-changing for Mexicans. And there was all kinds of hope that was generated. Perhaps there was too much hope that was generated. Perhaps there was too much desire to try to change all that had been created under 71 years of one-party rule. And there was no real way that that could be achieved. But there was so much hope, you know, because really this is a country filled with faith and hope because they haven't been able to have much else, you know? So so there was this but then as the years went on, President Fox revealed that he didn't quite have that very necessary characteristic to be this working politician in the rooms that we don't get to see to develop those political deals and make sure that some kind of progress is made. It just didn't happen. So as the years went on, we just found Mexico to find itself further and further into a situation which Mexicans call estancado. It means stuck, like stuck in the mud, stuck in a tar pit. We just couldn't move. The economy froze up. Whenever the United States economy starts to have a slight downturn, that has tremendous effects in Mexico because 90% of Mexico's exports go to the United States. So that started to slow down. Job creation wasn't occurring and political reforms didn't happen. And so Mr. Fox wanted to be known as the man who brought democracy. And I think people are going to have their doubts about that.
Let's talk with someone who is listening here who has a question and wants to be in on the conversation. The caller's in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Mr. Contreras, would it help to understand Mexico if we knew the political affiliations of the various governors of the Mexican states? You know, how many are PAN or PAM, I forget. How many are PRI?
That is... Yeah, absolutely. That's critical to understanding Mexican politics at this moment because, as I mentioned, There was one party rule for many years, as you know. This listener sounds like he knows Mexican politics to a certain degree. And I think that you understand that the presidency was all powerful. That means the president could change the governor or the Congress, you know, at a whim. With a number with a few phone calls, he could have the governor resign. The Congress could change or rubber stamp or block certain initiatives depending on what the president wanted. The president was all powerful. And this changed in the year 2000. This started to change before that, but it changed absolutely in the year 2000. So now all of a sudden we find that the governors play an absolutely critical role. There are 31 states in Mexico and a federal district, 32 in total. And the vast majority of those are controlled by the PRI. The Institutional Revolutionary Party. That's right. That is the opposition party that has, that we say, controlled Mexico for 71 years. So that's a very important point. When you look at the Mexican South, a good number of those states are still under control of the PRI at the governor's level. And the governors are very, very important because they manage federal funds that come into the states and start to disperse those or not disperse those, maybe pocket the money in many cases. So that's very important. After that, you'll find that there are states in the north that are governed by the PAN, the National Action Party, the Spanish acronym. And those are the states that are, of course, aligned with the president-elect, who is a member of the National Action Party. And a very smaller number in the Mexican South are now, and Mexico City, by the way, are governed by this left-leaning coalition called the PRD. These are the three main parties. There are certainly many other parties, but these are the main ones to talk about. And the PRI still holds a lion's share of those states. So I think that's a very important point that you've made here. And I think that few Mexicans even understand the importance of that political dynamic. Thank you for that question.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Certainly, one of the things that I wanted to have you talk a little bit about was what has happened with the PRI since 2000. Because as you mentioned, this was the first time that the power had been significantly shattered in all of those 71 years. They lost the presidency. On the other hand, there are still a lot of PRI people in the Congress, in the Mexican Congress, and as you say, a lot of governorships are held by the PRI. So that sort of makes you ask, well, yes, the party was certainly badly hurt in 2000, and their presidential candidate now this past summer finished, a rather distant third behind the two top candidates, Mr. Calderon and Mr. López Obrador. But so even though that is the case, the PRI still continues to have significant power in Mexican politics as a whole?
Absolutely, David. As our caller pointed out there, you know, the PRI, he wondered about the number of governorships, and we mentioned that the PRI still has that. But the PRI remains the most highly politically organized party in Mexico, and I would venture to say perhaps one of the most highly organized political machines in all of the Americas, and I would include the Republicans. We're talking about power base in every part of Mexico. Highly, highly organized political machinery here. Remember, 71 years gives you quite a bit of time to refine that and to install offices at the very local level. The PRI, to be able to maintain control, very, very intelligent machinery here. Remember, they held power for longer than, for example, the Communist Party and the USSR, longer than the Communist Party system in China. This is, you know, a very unusual political machine. So what did they do? How did they do that? They controlled the campesino, the peasant farmer class. There were peasant farmer organizations that could rise up, as they did in the Mexican Revolution time from 1910 to 1916. So to control that anger, they found a way to control that sector. They also controlled the unions, the labor unions were under control of the PRI. And so they had all these different legs holding up this table, this powerful political party. And it continues to be the most highly organized. The thing is, though, is that people realize that lots of the corruption that does still exist has a lot to do with that party structure that is still in place. So the party itself has had a very difficult time renovating itself, trying to renew itself and become this new democratic political party. I think that Mexico needs the PRI. I think there's no way to throw it out. And I think there's also, it's very important here to point out that the PRI is not a monolithical political machine. It is made up of so many different sectors that you'll find people who support free trade and people who are absolutely against it. They want to close off Mexico's economy again. There's a wide spectrum from the left to the right inside the PRI. And I think that it's very important to remember that they're going to be a player no matter what happens. And President-elect Felipe Calderón's party, the PAN, will have to negotiate with the PRI if he wants to make any kind of progress. And a lot of people in Mexico are very worried about that right now.
I would think that if you had a voter who maybe in the past had voted for the PRI and was thinking about doing that again in this past election and was kind of looking at the way things are going, I would think that they would be more likely if they were going to say, well, who might I also vote for? Well, it would be the PRD. I wouldn't think that they would go to the right. I would think that they would go to the left. I mean, did López Obrador make any attempt to reach out to people who identify with PRI and say to them, well, now look, do you want Felipe Calderón to be president of Mexico, or would you rather have me be president of Mexico? Is not my agenda closer to what your agenda is? And it seemed to me that he might have been able to drain off enough pre-voters to actually get enough votes to win. Because as we've said, and as people will remember, this election was very close between those two candidates.
The closest presidential election in Mexican history, by the way. Not only did the leftist candidate reach out to pre-voters, he also reached out to the pre-leadership and brought some of those people into the fold. And don't forget, Mr. López Obrador also came from the PRI. Like so many politicians in Mexico, this is the stunner. It's, you know, how can you have a one-party system and create politicians, career politicians, who don't have some kind of link to that system? So this is all... all at once, politically necessary, but at the same time, a frightening proposition for many people. Because if that old system still exists these ways, and you have people who move from one party to another, changing colors like a chameleon, what does that mean for Mexico's ability to change? And I think, you know, lots of people who are outside of the party system will say that's precisely why we don't change. Mm. They just simply change parties, change colors. That happens throughout Latin America, and we don't bring the necessary changes to the country. So,
I want to go on and make sure we talk about Oaxaca, because I know you were there recently, and this connects in interesting ways with some of the other things we've been talking about. Just one more question about the election of this last summer. As I mentioned, López Obrador said he thought that there was electoral fraud, and apparently there are survey polls have been taken, opinion polls of Mexicans, that have found something like at least a third of Mexicans actually think there was some fraud in this election. What's the judgment on that? Can one really say one way or another whether this was an absolutely free, fair election, or could there have been some fraud that would have benefited Mr. Calderón?
Okay, you know, as a journalist, I always want to cite the sources and say, you know, this official organization said this thing, this organization said that thing. Let me tell you what I think personally. Here it is. I think we just don't know. That's the problem. That was the problem here, because López Obrador was not just suggesting that there was fraud. He was also saying, let's go back and count each and every ballot, because that's the physical evidence of what took place here. The ballots do exist. The ballot showed the political party logo, and you took out a black Crayola and marked either an X or whatever you thought it was on top of that, on top of the logo type of the party you wanted to vote for, and put that in the box, and that's your vote. So those votes exist. They still not have been destroyed. They will be burned someday soon here. But López Obrador said, let's just count those ballots. One of the things that President Vicente Fox did that really I think we as journalists started to explain that was a very important change in Mexico was to open up a legal system for access to public information that you as a citizen should have to explain to you what your government is doing. And López Obrador and many other scholars, including American scholars living in Mexico now, explained that these freedom of information laws should then give people the right to look at the ballots and see what happened. But that didn't happen. And when I went personally to the Electoral Tribunal and filled out request forms, you know, to be able to see ballots, to be able to see the tally sheets. There was basically a stone wall that was put up. It was very bizarre to me, because if you call this an electoral democracy, then why can't we see the evidence of the vote itself? So so the problem, I think, is that we just don't know what happened. And I personally cannot tell you what happened. There are many Mexicans, because of a long history of electoral fraud, they're convinced that, you know, that there was some sort of fraud that took place. If you say one third of the voters believe that something went wrong, that some sort of dirty deed went on, then what does that do for the legitimacy of the incoming president in the eyes of that one third of the population that votes? It's not a good thing for the system, really. It's not a good thing for electoral democracy. I think that one of the things that we saw here was the weakening of the system. Rather than fertilizing, rather than, you know, making it a stronger institution coming out of this controversial election, we see that's all been weakened again. It reminded people very much of the presidential election in 1988, if you remember that. That was when Carlos Salinas de Gortari surprisingly won the election. There was a problem with the computer. I just mentioned this a few seconds ago. The computer crashes, and the next morning it's announced that the PRI candidate is the next president.
And this was it this that Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas was running against
That's
him?
Right.
And this, I think that ever after, I think a lot of people in Mexico, it would remind you of another election we've had here in the United States. A long time after that, a lot of people in Mexico felt that Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas was elected, that he was and should have been president of Mexico.
I think that Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, as you mentioned, the leader of this PRD party, the left-leaning party, a lot of people said that he won, you know, and so it created this lack of faith, this major distrust, you know. In the electoral party system. This happened in 1988. This happened during your life, in my lifetime. This happened just recently, you know? Mm-hmm. And this has happened right next door to us. So, I think that, you know, there are major questions about what happened in this election. People don't have the answers. The party in power wants to explain that everything's fine, and people have their doubts.
Mm-hmm. There is a law in Mexico that says the sitting president is not supposed to involve himself in the presidential contest. He's not supposed to say anything, not supposed to endorse candidates, just supposed to stay out of it. And I think that Mr. Fox created some controversy because people felt, indeed, that he had weighed in on the side of Calderon. Any shakeout from that?
Well, not much, really. Not much came out of that. There are actually laws that prohibit the president from getting involved in the political lead-up to an election in the time of the campaign. Why is that? That goes back to that strong presidency that I mentioned. Again, the all-powerful presidency, they call it presidencialismo in Mexico. And that was a direct result of this one-party rule system of 71 years, right? So to be able to do away with that, to be able to make sure that the president doesn't have too much influence in the election, they don't want him to say anything during the election, during the campaign. And Mr. Fox, unfortunately, did step into the fray. The Electoral Tribunal, on a couple of occasions, asked him to back down and actually asked him to take off the television. There was a number of announcements that Fox was broadcasting, mentioning, you know, how great his political party was and this sort of thing, sort of making these subtle references to, well, keep voting for us, you know. Mm-hmm. And they asked him to take those off the air, and Fox agreed, kind of quietly pulled those off the air. So there was a sense that he did overstep the legal boundaries, but nothing came of it. I think when the tribunal made its announcement in September of who the president-elect would be, they sort of gave a hand slap to President Fox, saying, you know, you shouldn't have done that, Mr. President, because it's just not right. And that was it. And people wondered, like, well, is, you know, do our legal system, does it actually have teeth? Or what happens here with this? So lots of questions come out of this presidential election. And we're wondering now just, you know, what the next turn will be.
We're a little bit past our midpoint. We have a caller we'll get to in right in just a moment. I do also want to introduce again our guest, if you have just tuned in, Frank Contreras. He's a Mexico correspondent for The World, the radio program that we broadcast here on AM 580, 3 in the afternoon and 7 at night during the week. He's been reporting from Mexico City and also around Latin America since 1996, covering Mexico. He's also reported from Guatemala, Nicaragua, Panama, Venezuela, He has contributed stories. They've been broadcast on NPR, on the BBC, on the CBC. He was one of the founding producers of the radio program Latino USA and also has worked for All Things Considered. He is visiting the campus. We'll be talking with journalists here, student journalists. He'll also be giving a talk on contemporary Mexican politics that's open to anybody who would like to attend. That's tonight at 7 o'clock in room 180 of Bevere Hall, so if you'd like to attend. Questions welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller locally in Champaign County, line 1. Hello.
Good morning. I have a couple questions about Mexico, but if I might pitch a story about Guatemala for you to do.
Please. I wanted to invite you and every listener. If you have any story ideas, send them to us. This is an unusual opportunity now as a correspondent for me to come in and hear directly from you. So thank you. Yes.
Well, the Guatemala thing I'll just mention then. The Knight Center down in UT, which I guess you must have been at, has a series of stories about intimidation of journalists in Guatemala. I don't think the world has covered that as far as I can recollect.
That'll be something to look into, yeah.
The head of the Community Radio Federation in Guatemala was kidnapped and tortured and released. A couple of other journalists, one guy was shot in the face while on the air. I think the other one was killed after a party or something like that. So this is the nation that we wanted to be on, the Security Council, indeed. But on the electoral process, the other thing that there were complaints about, sort of structural complaints in Mexico, was outside money, and specifically U.S. corporate money. I don't know if there was a slap of the wrists or the hands in that regard, but that was another complaint from Obrador's camp. And so it isn't just happening down there. The U.S. has a very, very vested interest in the situation. I do have another thing more general, but if you'd ask, respond to that.
Yeah, well,
absolutely. Thank you. Yes, you mentioned that the United States has a vested interest in Mexico. Absolutely. Not just because it is one of our most important trading partners, but also because of this very personal relationship now that we have between the United States and Mexico. Mexicans are in every county now in the United States. Everywhere you go, you will find the Mexican presence. And there are lots of Americans. More Americans live in Mexico than any other country outside of our boundaries. So there's this very personal tie that goes on. You asked the question about the influence of either foreign corporations or foreign interests in the Mexican electoral process of this year, 2006. And you asked about, was there any slap on the wrist that occurred? So unfortunately, I cannot report that there was no slap on the wrist. There was no mention of that, and not much investigation at this stage. I'm sure that people are digging around to try to find out just actually what happened with that. But Mexico's electoral laws are very clear. This is illegal activity. It's not allowed under the electoral laws in Mexico, and there's a sense that it did happen. Now, one of the things that I should say is that when you look back at the television ads, very interesting television attack ads that were produced in favor of Mr. Felipe Calderón, in one case you would see the video images and the voice of the Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, and then all of a sudden the photo of López Obrador would come on and the narrator would explain that these two men are very dangerous. And very dangerous for Mexico. And it turns out that behind the attack ads, there were a good number of U.S. spin doctors who were contracted, who came in from Washington and New York and provided their services, I'm sure at a good fee, and influenced the way television attack ads were produced. It had very much a U.S. sort of style and presence that we had not seen in previous elections. And so so that kind of presence was also present there. We also saw that. I don't think that the electoral laws say anything about, you know, whether a U.S. spin doctor can come in or not. That's allowed, I think. But as far as the corporations and the political interests of the State Department, there's no way of tracking that at this stage. We talked about the access of information laws, but at this stage, no documents to show anything on that on that matter. So nothing to report to you. We will be looking into that, though. Thank you.
Well, Walmart was one of the bigger funders of these ads, I understand. So we're exporting democracy American style, apparently. Well, I wanted to ask about this the bomb attack and this coalition of groups. It's kind of unreported here that there are guerrilla forces, guerrilla state. We know about Oaxaca. We know about Chiapas. But there's something like six ongoing armed rebellions, if I recall. And was this a coalition of all these different groups, or can you describe what you know of? Obviously, they don't respond to freedom of information either. Thanks.
Yes, thank you. The question of guerrilla armed groups in Mexico. Mexico has its own intelligence agency. It's called CISEN. CISEN. So it's an intelligence agency that collaborates very much with the CIA here. You can imagine that the CIA and Washington is very interested to know whether or not there are armed guerrilla organizations just south of our border, and there are. This week, at least five of these armed organizations emerged, and immediately, well, not immediately, but a day after the bombings that took place last week in Mexico City, the guerrilla organizations emerged and explained that they were taking responsibility for that. These are armed groups from the states that you mentioned, Chiapas, Oaxaca, and Guerrero. These are the most southern states in Mexico, the most indigenous states. They're the poorest states. They have more in common with Central America than they do with the rest of Mexico. And this is the place where you will see armed conflict still in place. A lot of these guerrilla organizations tried to emerge in the mid-90s. You saw the Zapatista Rebellion, but there was also a group called the EPR that emerged in Oaxaca and a good number of other coalition organizations. I won't spell out the alphabet soup. It'll get too confusing on the radio, but I think it's important to know that there are a good number. Some of these organizations recently emerged, so it looks like they're trying to sort of get into the act here, if you will. And it's hard to tell you at this point just how well armed they are, what kinds of weaponry they may own. There was a suggestion at one point that some had surface-to-air missiles. There's no longer any indication of that, but they certainly used plastic explosives in the bomb blast that we saw. Let me explain. There were three different sites that were attacked last week. Bombs went off at the headquarters of the Institutional Revolutionary Party. One of the main auditoriums there had the front end of it blown off. A very important symbolic statue of the creator, the founder of the PRI, fell over into rubble. And a bomb blast also went off at the Federal Electoral Tribunal. This is the electoral court that decided this controversial presidential election. And a bomb blast went off at Scotiabank, which is owned by Canadian banking interests. So the organizations, as I mentioned, pointed out that that these are symbolic organizations. These are, you know, the institutions that affect poor Mexicans in the most difficult way. And so they suggest that to add Oaxaca to the mix now, that unless the governor in Oaxaca state resigns, we'll talk about that in a second, unless he resigns, these kinds of attacks will continue. So who are these organizations? The Mexican intelligence agency is still trying to dig that out. We have an idea that some of them are based in Oaxaca, in the southern state of Oaxaca, also in that neighboring state of Guerrero, which you mentioned. That's where Acapulco is located, by the way, if you've been to Mexico. And there are some guerrilla organizations, in fact, in Mexico City as well.
I wanted to move on to, we've said a couple times, I want to talk about Oaxaca. I guess this has been in the news recently. It's my understanding that every year for something like 26 years, the teachers in Oaxaca staged a demonstration. It was an annual event. They staged this demonstration to make their demands that they be paid better. And that this year, for some reason, the governor moved against the demonstrators. She actually used force against the demonstrators. And then this escalated into something much, much bigger that involved a lot more people, and then led to this demand that the governor step down. And this went on for months until finally the president, Mr. Fox, apparently decided that this just could not go on, and he sent in the federal police. I want to have you talk about what exactly this is about, and whether or not the governor, Ulises Ruiz, is eventually going to have to go because of the way that this went.
Well, let's get the history nailed down here. You have it exactly right. It begins in May 22nd, to be exact. It's an annual teacher strike. These teachers get paid $300 a month. Okay, think about that. $300. Now, one of the teachers explained to me that she works in a mountain village. There are 500 county seats, more than 500 county seats in Oaxaca. Imagine that. This is a country where when the conquistador Hernan Cortes went back to Madrid after he achieved the conquest in New Spain, the king asked him, explain to me what Oaxaca is like. He was going to be given a piece of land. So he took out a piece of paper, crumbled it up like that, and he unfolded it, and all these wrinkles on the paper. He said, that's Oaxaca. It's two systems of Sierra mountains that come together, knotted together, sprinkle in more than 500 county seats. And you begin to see how complex that state is. 16 different indigenous languages are spoken in Oaxaca. It is one of the most language-diverse areas in the world. Only India has more languages spoken than, you know, in comparison with Oaxaca. So the teachers are working in this situation. Some of them will take a 18-hour bus ride from the state capital up to the mountains through these very dodgy, muddy roads, where, you know, landslides occur because of the rains. And then they have to get out and walk another 8 hours or 10 hours into the mountains, where they'll find this little school that has no electricity, no bathroom, no desks. And the little children come, and as I reported recently, they'll come to school and they'll have a little bit of food. They bring a corn tortilla and some salt, and that's what they eat. So we're talking about places that the United Nations Fund for Development has compared to other parts of Africa in terms of its development level. These are the situations, this is the conditions that these striking teachers find themselves in. They're asking for this salary raise, as they do every year. And what happened? Well, the governor had his attention on the presidential election, because his very close ally was the PRI candidate Roberto Madrazo, who comes from the so-called dinosaur wing of the PRI, the Institutional Revolutionary Party. And it's that old-style political system that governed Mexico with a heavy hand for such a long time. This is the political form that this governor prefers to choose. And so he's focusing his attention on trying to gain these votes for the presidential candidate of the PRI. And all of a sudden, the strike comes up. It goes to mid-June. And the governor says to his second man in charge, well, take care of it. You know, just go take care of that for me, will you? So what does the guy do? He sends in the shock troops. He sends in state-level police. Pitched battles go on. They remove the protesters from the main central square there, which we call the Zócalo. And that just infuriated people. You know, how can you not only keep us in these poverty conditions, but also all of a sudden use the police against us? We don't even have the right to protest now. There's no other system for calling attention. There's no referendum. There's no plebiscite. You know, so what else can we do? So all of a sudden, as you mentioned, David, this turns into this giant movement to oust the governor. An organization arises calling itself APO, A-P-P-O. It means the Popular Assembly of the Oaxacan People. It's structured with the indigenous ways of creating local governments. And they're now calling for the ouster of this governor. And there have been pitched battles. I saw one or two of those personally recently in the beginning of November, right after President Fox sent in federal police to try to calm down the situation. By the way, President Fox made that decision. He waited a while. He didn't want to stain his hands in blood, as the Mexicans say. He's just a few weeks away from ending his presidency. He wanted to sort of end it on a clean note. So he waited and waited and waited a little too long. It got very violent, and even an American citizen was killed there. You heard about that. Yeah. Independent journalist Bradley Will was killed, 36 years old. I'm not saying that this guy was very much of a radical man. He had a video camera. He would go in. He met a lot of the teachers. They knew who he was. He wasn't the kind of guy that would take risks as a journalist, but he found himself in this alleyway when all of a sudden some armed men showed up. Apparently there were local police in civilian clothing firing into the crowd. And unfortunately, this American citizen was hit and killed. And after that, immediately, the president took the step of sending in the federal police. And there have been a great number of pitched battles where, you know, to go in there, you really have to wear a bulletproof vest and this kind of thing. We're talking about serious conflict here between the protesters and the state police to try to, you know, end this situation. So it's very complicated. I'd like to explain a lot more. There's so much more to say. I invite you to join us tonight at 7 for the talk.
Will the governor have to go?
Well, There are even people in the Institutional Revolutionary Party, high-ranking senators there, who say he must go. Mm. At this moment, I received this morning an email from the Interior Ministry, where the Interior Minister now is saying that, you know, that this governor should take the steps to bring peace, and that means leaving office. So the thing is, if he holds on through December, then this embattled governor can name his predecessor. But if he quits any day now, then there's going to have to be a new election. And if that happens, it turns out that he put a lot of attention on the presidential election, as I said, but the PRI ended up losing terribly in Oaxaca. And not only did it lose the presidency, it also lost great numbers in the local Congress. So now the new party that emerges in power there is this left-leaning party belonging to López Obrador.
The PRD. So the PRI could lose that governorship if there's an election. And it could pass to the PRD.
That's what this is about, really. Wow. And remember that the PAN, which holds power now, is negotiating with the PRI to try to create some sort of power block in the Senate and the lower house of Congress so that Mr. Calderon can pass his reforms. To do that, he has to sort of placate the PRI, and that may mean let this governor stand for a few more weeks, name his predecessor, and let's get on with it. But it becomes a very dangerous situation. Yeah.
Well, that again indeed says that this is kind of a microcosm of the forces that are at play on the national level and the larger level in Mexico.
Absolutely. As I mentioned, this organization called APPO, I don't like to use acronyms very much on the radio, but it's important because these popular assemblies are now starting to crop up in a number of other states. For example, in the western state of Michoacan, which sends so many migrants to the United States, there are great numbers of communities there that are absolutely empty year-round because, you know, their inhabitants are in California or some other part of the U.S. And that's the state where Felipe Calderon is from. Well, all of a sudden now there's a popular assembly there. There's a popular assembly in the state of Mexico, which is the most populous state, the most important industrial state, which wraps itself all the way around the federal district just about. And there's a popular assembly there, as I mentioned. There's a popular assembly in Guerrero. So these are starting to crop up. I'm not suggesting that this is a national movement all of a sudden, but it is certainly worrisome for the incoming president.
Yeah. We have a couple of minutes left. Maybe we might return to the subject of the relationship between Mexico and the United States. I think that when Vicente Fox was elected, a lot of people thought, well, this will be good for the U.S.-Mexico relationship. And I assume that they were thinking that in terms of their politics, George Bush and Vicente Fox would be compatible. And that this time around, I think that probably the United States would be something of an understatement to say it was pleased to see Mr. Calderon win, that they felt it would have been much more complicated to have to deal with López Obrador. But the U.S.-Mexico relationship, during the time that Mr. Fox has been president, hasn't been what I think people thought. 9/11 came along. That diverted the attention of the United States. Mexico didn't support the Iraq War. That was not good for the relationship. So now, what possibility is there, you know, what potential do you think there would be for perhaps a better working relationship, a closer relationship now between the United States and Mexico now that we have a new president, same party, but another guy?
Well, as you know, David, just a few days ago, Felipe Calderon was in Washington meeting with President Fox and meeting with Condoleezza Rice at the State Department. And just a few days before that, he started to send out press releases to us journalists there. And he said that, you know, he's toning down expectations. When President Fox made his first visit to the White House, you know, he was shown in his cowboy boots alongside our president in his cowboy boots. They were, you know, shown hugging each other. They rode horses together in Mexico. President Bush said that Fox, that Mexico was, you know, one of our best friends. And then 9/11 occurs and this sort of starts to disappear, as you say. So Calderon right now is starting to, you know, reach out to the United States, as is absolutely necessary, by the way, for Mexico, and Mexicans understand that. But at the same time, he's toning things down. He's trying to lower the expectations that there will be some sort of sweeping immigration accord. No matter the fact that the Democrats have just rewon the Senate and the Congress, there's a sense that there may not be this sweeping accord that Mexico so much wants to see, so badly wants to see. So I think that you know, he wants to talk about political stability. He wants to assure Washington that the kind of instability that we're seeing in Oaxaca will not spread. that there will be some sort of job growth that goes on. He's made a sort of number of concessions that, you know, we can sort of make gains in the bilateral relationship if Mexico can achieve these other goals. One of them, of course, is doing something about the level of corruption in the police forces and something about narco trafficking, which is a major, major problem now, and the level of violence that has gone on this year, something that has also gone underreported. So I think that, you know, Calderon steps forward. He wants to reach out his hand in friendship. He also knows that, you know, he doesn't want to anger Washington, so he's going to back down on this demand that Fox pushed so heavily to remake U.S. immigration laws. And he's going to try to do what he can, but I think I'm sure that he's quite worried.
But it's still in this government in Mexico. They still like the kinds of things that President Bush has proposed when the president essentially proposed a guest worker program for the United States, which was met, as you say, with great opposition by Republicans, particularly in the House. Now, you know, who knows what's going to happen with the change of power. But that's still something in Mexico they would like to see. Would it be easier for Mexicans to come to the United States to work?
Well, at all levels. I mean, I think I talk to friends who are professionals and they don't come to the United States because they can't get a visa. These are people who have good paying jobs. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they tell me things like, you know what, Frank, I don't even care about the United States. I don't even want to know anything about it. I say, but, you know, Illinois, you got to get to know Chicago. What an amazing city. And they say, I don't care. I'm going to go to France, you know, because there's this tension that has built up over the years because it's so difficult for many people to get a visa, whether you're, you know, the kind of person who would come in legally or try to enter illegally. It's just been so difficult. And so, yes, there are a good number of people who would like to see that erased. The whole idea of building fences, by the way, shocks Mexicans. They don't call them fences, by the way. They call it the wall of shame. When you translate the words from Spanish into English, it's the wall of shame. And they just wonder, you know, how can you have this rhetoric of saying that we're such important partners and friends, and then you're building this wall?
We're going to have to leave it at that. With our thanks to our guest, Frank Contreras, he's Mexico correspondent for The World. You can hear his reports here on AM 580 as part of The World, 3 in the afternoon, 7 in the evening. He's been reporting from Mexico City and around Latin America now for more than 10 years for NPR, BBC, CBC. He's here visiting the campus. He'll be giving a talk on contemporary Mexican politics tonight at 7 o'clock in room 180 of Bevere Hall. So if you'd like to hear more, you should go. Thanks very much.
David, I want to tell you, this has been the most in-depth conversation I've had about Mexico in my 10 years of coverage.
Well, we're glad to have you here to be able to do it.
Thank you for doing that. Thank you. Thank you for listening.
It.